You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
So today's address, why Unitarianism? What are we doing sitting in this place? Why aren't we down the road at another? The coffee shop where most people find their community on a Sunday morning, having breakfast. Why Unitarianism? Our community here consists of adherents who have a broad range of reasons for being interested in and taking up membership of this Unitarian Fellowship. For some, there is a generational link behind their membership. Others have come to Unitarianism as part of their spiritual journey and a quest for a community to which they feel they could belong. When Helen and I came across the Nord Unitarian community about 15 years ago, we were looking for a spiritual home after having had experience of both Christian and Eastern religions. So what was your experience of coming to Unitarianism and your journey? Be great if we had time today to go around and hear everybody's story, but we don't. But perhaps we'll get the chance to hear that as time goes on, because we're always looking for somebody to take this space in this free pulpit from which I'm speaking this morning. In the 2019 congregational survey that many of us took part in, the comments from that survey about their theological beliefs ranged from atheism, humanism, Christian, Buddhism, Judaism, Theosophy, and Agnosticism. Despite this broad variety of backgrounds, we are linked by the seven principles of Unitarianism, which I don't intend to go through here now, but they're available in the foyer if you want to refresh your memories, or online to replenish that knowledge of them. But why Unitarianism, as distinct from other religious communities? What sets us apart? Do we need to be apart? Is it perhaps the symbol of the flaming chalice which makes us unique? Three children were talking about their religions. I'm a Catholic, said one, and our symbol is the cross. The next one said, I'm Jewish, and our symbol is the Star of David. The third child said, I'm a Unitarian, and our symbol is a candle in a cocktail glass. When I first became a Unitarian, it was suggested by some that instead of the flaming chalice, our symbol could be a large question mark. This would be symbolic of Unitarians' constant quest of questioning and searching for answers. And an example of this could be the following. A Unitarian dies and on the way to the afterlife encounters a fork in the road with two options, to heaven, to discussion of heaven. Without pausing, the Unitarian heads right to the discussion of heaven, which is no surprise to most of us. The other point of symbols is that they ought to be recognisable. That is, when viewed by others outside of the organisation, how identifiable of that organisation are the symbols which are representing them? I wonder how many people passing our meeting house on a regular basis notice our symbol out the front during the day, or when it's more obviously lit up at night. I've yet to meet anyone who claimed that they had come into this community because of the symbol. I was raised a Baptist, and on the front of the church that I attended, which was a large imposing structure on a main street, was a neon sign, didn't flash, but it was on all the time at night, which said, Jesus saves. In my long connection with that church, I never met one person who was drawn into that building by that sign. In this time when many Christian churches are developing or have developed a more liberal attitude towards religion, I believe that Unitarians, as Unitarians, we can't simply rely on our liberal attitude towards religious thought as setting us apart or offering something different from mainstream religious communities. The same can be said of our humanism and our social justice attitudes, of which Unitarianism has a long and proud history. We have a non-Trinitarian theology, but this doesn't set us apart. For example, Jehovah's Witnesses also have a non-Trinitarian theology. So what, if anything, does Unitarianism offer that is different to other groups? Maybe the answer lies in our search for answers and our ability to question. It might also lie in our rejection of the supernatural aspects of some religions. The other question that could also be asked is it necessary for us to focus on the differences that set us apart from others? In that, as a community, we prefer to focus our efforts on living in this world, attempting to make the world a better place for all, rather than focusing on how we might best be able to receive a better deal in the afterlife by doing good deeds in this life. Instead of saving souls from eternal damnation, Unitarians would rather focus on enabling our fellow human beings, as well as ourselves, to become the best that we can be, holding others in dignity and worth, living those words from one of our hymns, which is one of my favourites, "For everyone born, a place at the table." And I won't go through the lyrics, but I do really like the words in that. Or, in other words, focusing our efforts on the here and now, not on the promise of some utopian existence in a dimension some choose to call heaven, but we call a mystery. However, when a decision to take up the mantle of improving all of humanity's lot is made by an individual, there comes the realisation, what a mammoth task that is. The problem is, how as an individual do you deal with the challenge of that magnitude? As Unitarians, we have a strong history of challenging the status quo. So this chap here, Michael Servetus, way back in the 1500s, in a country that doesn't even exist anymore, Transylvania, was one of our forefathers in Unitarianism. Some websites claim that the pharaoh Akhenaten, 15,000 years before the Common Era, was possibly the first Unitarian. Akhenaten, the pharaoh, decided he wasn't going along with all their myriad of gods, that there was only one god. And so he moved the capital away from Memphis, out into the desert, built a new capital with temples, and his followers followed him. Well, that didn't go very well, because the priests who'd been in charge of the old religion didn't like it, had an uprising, and Akhenaten and all his followers were killed, and the city was abandoned. What about Michael Servetus? He published a book on the errors of the Trinity, where he stated that the doctrine of the Trinity has no basis in Scripture and was thus a later invention. You can imagine how well that went down with the established church. The Council of Venice, representing Anabaptist Protestants in the northeast of Italy and Switzerland, adopted a 10-point statement of faith stating, among other things, that Jesus was only human. This movement was crushed a few years later by the Roman Inquisition. For his work, The Restoration of Christianity, Servetus was condemned and sentenced to death in absentia by the Roman Inquisition. However, while travelling through Geneva, Switzerland, he was discovered, tried by the Protestant Church Council led by John Calvin, and burned at the stake along with his writings. Didn't go that well for him, did it? Joseph Priestley, in the 1700s, and you'll have heard his name before, and I know that he's been mentioned from the lectern here before. Although oxygen was his most important discovery, Priestley also described the isolation and identification of other gases such as ammonia, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, and nitrogen dioxide. And the extrapolation of that is that he gave us soda water, which we use in our soft drinks, I guess. He soon became involved with the Lunar Society, a small group of academics, scientists, and industrialists with wide-ranging interests who were prominent in spearheading the Industrial Revolution in England. Although Priestley played an active role in the Lunar Society, his interests turned more and more towards theology. He became an active dissenter with outspoken criticism of the established church. These were dangerous times to be alive, with the French Revolution occurring around the same time. And, not surprisingly enough, Priestley supported the French Revolution. But the French Revolution sent shockwaves around Europe. In 1791, on the second anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, a church and king mob in Birmingham destroyed the new meeting house as well as Priestley's house and laboratory. He barely escaped with his life, and records were lost as well as his equipment. Priestley brutally joined a dissenting group in London at Hackney, but after renewed vitriol against him and his family, he emigrated to the United States of America in 1794, where he set up a ministry in the new colonies. And so really was one of the principal people in taking Unitarianism to the United States. Ralph Waldo Emerson, who preferred to be called Waldo Emerson, was an American essayist, lecturer, philosopher, and poet who led the Transcendentalist movement of the mid-19th century. He was seen as a champion of individualism and a prescient critic of the countervailing pressures of society, and he disseminated his thoughts through dozens of published essays and more than 1,500 public lectures across the United States. I did like this quote. I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. In 1831 and 1832, the younger Emerson became embroiled in a controversy at Second Church, which was in the New England states. As a Unitarian Christian minister, Emerson was expected to regularly conduct a communion service. So in the early days of Unitarianism, many of the Christian practices of communion followed very much along the line of the Anglican Church. Even here in Australia, going back only into the 1970s and 1980s, there was still, when I've had a look through the church service books of that time, they follow a very prescribed process there following that. Well, this didn't sit well with Emerson, that he had to conduct a regular communion service. He didn't find the act of communion personally meaningful because he was interested in a depth of authentic personal experience with the sacred that did not have room for the sake of ritual. Emerson told his congregation he would no longer offer the sacrament of communion. He never disavowed Unitarianism or his status as a minister, but he did leave the church because he didn't feel that he could continue. He never again used his title Reverend nor served a congregation. Instead, he chose to express himself through lecturing and writing. Of course, Catherine Helen Spence. Catherine Helen Spence was Australia's first truly female journalist and first woman political candidate, as well as a fearless social and political reformer in South Australia. Her influence on suffrage, culminating in South Australia being the first state in the world to give women the right to stand for parliament, extended beyond Australia. As an indication of her continuing influence, Adelaide's daily newspaper, The Advertiser, on the 20th December 1999, included Catherine Helen Spence in its list of the 10 greatest South Australians of the 20th century, and this despite the fact that most of her work was done in the 19th century. Spence's role in Federation was recognised nationally by her placement on one side of Australia's 2001 Federation $5 note, with Sir Henry Parkes, the founder of Federation, on the other. She was also a teacher, lecturer, preacher. She took many services in this church, not this actual physical church, but in this community, and was a dedicated social reformer. In her later years, she was known as the Grand Old Woman of Australia, and she died in 1910. And one of her endearing sayings evidently was, "I was given a proposal of marriage twice and refused twice." Of course, individuals such as Michael Servetus, Priestley, Waldo Emerson, and Catherine Helen Spence have played great individual roles as leaders in Unitarian theology, but they haven't done this alone. They've had the support of kindred people, like-minded people. We have inherited a strong history of Unitarians who have been prepared to step apart from the established order of religious thought in order to have the freedom to express and practice their beliefs. Now, ask Jane if she'd come forward for reading this morning.
There's only one reason for joining a Unitarian church, and that is to support it. You want to support it because it stands for something. It means something to support it. You want to support it because it stands against superstition and fear, because it points to what is noblest and best in human life, because it is open to men and women of whatever race, creed, colour, or place of origin. You want to support a Unitarian church because it has a free pulpit, because you can hear ideas expressed here which would cost any other minister his or her job. You want to support it because it's a place where children can come without being saddled with guilt or terrified of some celestial peeping Tom, where they can learn that religion is for joy, for comfort, for gratitude and love. You want to support it because it is a place where walls between people are torn down rather than built up, because it is a place for the displaced persons of our time, the unwanted free thinkers, and those who insist against orthodoxy that they must find their own beliefs. You want to support a Unitarian church because it's more concerned with people than dogmas, because it searches for the holy rather than dwells on the depraved, because it calls no one a sinner, yet knows how deep is the struggle in each person's breast and how great is our hunger for what is good. You want to support a Unitarian church because it can laugh, and you want to support it because it insults neither your intelligence nor your conscience, and because it calls you to worship what is truly worthy of your sacrifice. Yes, there's only one reason for joining a Unitarian church: to support it.
Thank you, Jane. And thank you, Margaret, for pointing that reading out. There is an African proverb that states, "If you want to run fast, run alone. If you want to run far, run together." That was a quote during President Biden's inauguration, and it's kind of stuck in my mind. It reminded me of an example from the animal world. One of the fastest animals on earth is a cheetah. However, this places some limitations on the cheetah's hunting ability. Cheetahs mainly hunt alone, and although they have incredible speed, they are unable to maintain that speed for long periods of time. If they do not make their kill quickly, there's a strong chance that they won't be successful. On the other hand, lions that are not as fast often hunt in groups or prides. They plan their attacks, and each individual has a designated role to play in helping to bring about a successful hunt. We were lucky enough to be in Kenya 18 months ago, I think it is now, and we were in a conservation park. And it was getting towards dusk. We were going back to the lodge, and Helen spotted a young lion on the road, and she was frightened. The driver hadn't seen it, so he called out and he stopped. And then he said, "That lion won't be alone. They're hunting." So we stood and looked around in the car, and we found, I think there were six, and they were spaced strategically around the landscape. And there was a herd of other animals coming from the other direction that they knew about. Well, we didn't stay there right that close. He took us back into the lodge, but we still had a view out over that from the lodge. And as this other herd came through, all of a sudden, the lions just pounced and went into that, and they worked as a group and they got their kill. So it was an amazing example of how they are successful at hunting. The lions still move at a considerable pace, but they use the strength of numbers and teamwork to achieve their goal. I have just a simple, and forgive me if you've seen this before. It's the old example of a match. You know, if you have one match by itself, it can be broken. So what? Well, I don't know, when you light a match, you know that it burns the headpiece first and then burns down the match. But if it's broken apart, it's not going to stay there for very long, is it? But if you bring more than that one match, just a few matches together, and okay, you can say I'm weak, I can't do it, but to break them, I'm really giving it my best shot, can't be done, because they support each other and their weight's there, and you can think of some others. It's a very simple demonstration of the strength of numbers. And the analogy works well when we consider our Unitarian community. And that's what we're going to be doing after the service this morning in the AGM, coming together as a community for a common purpose and a common goal. The importance of supporting each other in our spiritual journey, applying our seven principles in our dealings with humanity and the environment is paramount. Alone, we are limited in what we can achieve. Together, respecting each other's individualities and strengths, we can achieve so much more. These closing words from our member, Daphne Treloar. The peace of being at one. As we leave this place, may we take with us the peace of being at one, with the world and with all humanity. May we regard each contact as precious, each opportunity as unique, and live every moment as we would our last. So be it.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.